As long as we're identifying with the content of our mind, we're constantly at the mercy of that movement of content of thought. So then there can happen this recognition that actually the content itself is simply like a movie projected on the screen, right? And yet there is a light that makes that projection possible.
Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. My name is Rick Archer. Buddha at the Gas Pump is an ongoing series of conversations with spiritually awakening people. I've done about 750 of them now, and if this is new to you and you'd like to check out previous ones, please go to batgap.com and look under the interviews menu. And underneath that, we have a bunch of different categories of ways that we've organized the interviews. Should be self-evident if you look there. This program is made possible through the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So if you appreciate it and you would like to help support it, please go to the website and you'll see PayPal buttons and a page with alternatives to PayPal. My guest today is Kogan Zarnik. Is that the right pronunciation?
It's Zarnik? But it's good enough.
Don't ask me to do that. Yeah.
It's really great.
Kogan is in Poland and from Poland. He's one of these brother from another mother guests on BatGap because he has some ways of seeing things that are very similar to my own, even though our backgrounds are very different. For instance, he says he considers himself and all human beings a work in progress. And if you've been watching this show for the past 17 years, you've probably heard me say that hundreds of times. And he's also, as was his teacher, concerned about ethical considerations on the spiritual path, which some people dismiss as irrelevant or illusory or something, but I don't believe Kogan does. Rather than my reading the bio he sent me, which would be boring because you'd have to hear me reading it for a couple minutes, I'm just going to have Kogan start in and tell us a little bit about himself, and then we will get rolling on all the points we want to discuss. So where would you like to start? Another thing we have in common is you were a bit of a wild teenager, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
And then you got on the spiritual path.
I mean, first of all, thanks a lot, Rick, for having me. I'm a huge appreciator of your show. I think you're doing great stuff for the overall spiritual community. So
thanks.
So, yeah.
Like yourself, you know, it feels good to try to make a contribution to the world.
Yeah. So, I mean, I certainly had like a not necessarily promising spirituality childhood. You know, I had a good family. I had really decent and loving parents. So there's nothing there. But sometimes, you know, people are asked like, oh, were you kind of having those spiritual inclinations as a kid? And I always say like, no, I was actually, you know, a straight kid in Poland at the time when the communists fall. And before we get into EU, there was this kind of dark period where the collective dream of Poland, which we were, you know, I guess under occupation of different kinds for 150 years, there's this collective dream that the political freedom will bring happiness. And once that wasn't delivered, there was this sense of great disappointment and there was a lot of crime. It was pretty rough, you know, living in the projects. So for myself, you know, I was taking every opportunity, you know, as a street kid, either shoplifting or stealing wallets to have for drugs or mugging people or whatnot. So that's my honest answer about my kind of spiritual inclinations as a young kid. But I guess maybe what kind of was slightly standing out in all of that was also I kind of had this real curiosity about mind-altering substances. There was this kind of feeling of something is just not right the way things are, the way I'm kind of experiencing reality. And as a young child, I of course, I wasn't necessarily shoplifting, but it was more this sort of like teenage years when this sense of being something in particular started to really set in. There was this kind of reactivity against it and dissatisfaction. So I guess I tried weed first time when I was 12 or something and you know, tried different things. And I guess in the end, there was some saving grace in that because I encountered psychedelics and had some experiences that were really transformative and showing me the potential of human mind and how much potential there is in our consciousness. And that really helped me set off on kind of different trajectory there.
Similar to my story, except I wasn't mugging people. But the thing that really hit me when I first did LSD was the realization that everybody sees the world so differently. You know, I thought it was the same world and everybody saw it that way. And all of a sudden I'm seeing it so differently. And I went into a shop to buy donuts and I saw the ladies in the shop were obviously seeing the world so differently than I was. And it kind of dawned on my very confused teenage mind that the name of the game must be to change the way you see the world rather than just trying to change the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, those are portals and they can be, you know, profoundly useful. They have their own dangers. And in my case, I never felt like it was like an ongoing affair. Like I felt like almost my second mushroom trip and my second LSD trip were the most powerful. And after that, I was kind of trying to recreate it for a while and just never hitting the same mark. And after some time, I just decided it's probably not in those substances. It has to be possible to find in other ways.
And you eventually got into Zen. It was Zen that inspired me to learn meditation, although I didn't learn Zen, but I was reading Zen books. In fact, it was on my last hallucinogenic trip that I was sitting there reading a Zen book, Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And I thought, wow, you know, these guys were really serious and I'm just screwing around. And I think I'd better learn something more serious and stop doing this kind of thing. And then I got myself into learn meditation and it really had a profound effect. But how did you go through that transition from your wild and crazy period to something more serious?
I think, you know, I was lucky. I had a lot of great friends around me and we were all kind of spiritually curious right at that time when we were discovering psychedelics and different people are just reading different books. I mean, everything from like really odd stuff like Aleister Crowley's books to Carlos Castaneda to some Zen books. And in the process, we would do some practice together. And through that quick discernment time, I quickly arrived at Zen just was really speaking to me. And I think it was also because Zen is this, at least it used to be initially in Tang Dynasty China, this sort of rebel kind of maverick movement of breaking off from the sort of worship-based spirituality. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think there was like really formalized and sort of doctrinal Buddhism in China at the time. And Zen came in and was this disruptive force of pure awakening and the sort of radical simplicity. So reading those books, I really had that sense of there's something real in that and wanted to explore that. You know, later I kind of learned that that style kind of has disappeared mostly. The literature is there and all the stories are repeated, but maybe the sort of teaching style kind of got a little bit tamed, especially when it came to Japan. And Japan is also, everybody likes the structure and all that. So through those practices with friends, I read a couple books to like, you know, Three Pillars of Zen and The Way of Zen by Alan Watts. And I just decided to pursue that in some kind of more formal context.
And then you went to, was it Japan or Korea?
It was Japan initially. I mean, first I actually practiced with Jaksho Kwangroshi of Sonoma Mountain Zen Center. He was actually the same teacher that Adyashanti used to do his retreats with. He's from Sonoma Mountain Zen Center. And he used to come to Poland for month and a half of every year, and we were doing like a month-long retreat with him. So he was my first teacher there. My background was like being a musician, so I was trained in elementary school and high school and conservatory.
What'd you play?
Classical singing was my primary thing, although I played piano and some other instruments. But through that, you know, being in those institutions, it was just my natural inclination, or, you know, whoever, someone might say it's kind of karmic. I thought like, okay, just as I'm in a music conservatory right now, which is the best possible institution if you want to become a musician, there has to be an equivalent of that to become a realized person. In Poland, it was just at the beginning of this century, so there was not many residential places. Everything was, you know, like in my city, we used to like rent a little place on the attic or in a basement and, you know, sometimes sitting meditation and hearing the rats running on the pipes. You know, it's very kind of low budget. This is the very start of the whole thing. So I felt like if I want to really dive into it, it's just I felt that calling to go deeper and went to Japan.
I did visit a Zen Roshi one time after I had already been doing TM for a few months because I thought this is too easy. This TM thing, it's relaxing. I like it. I'm getting great benefits, but it's got to be harder than this. And so I went into the you know, Zen Center in New York and had a little Q&A with the guy and participated in a group meeting. And then after that, I went to another TM talk and decided to become a TM teacher. Zen has a reputation of not being easy, of being really intense and harsh, and they whack you with sticks, and you have to sit in lotus even though you're in agony. You know, you can't fall asleep or you get hit with a stick. So I don't know if I would have done too well if I'd pursued that path, but you kind of rose to the occasion and muscled on through it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like a tough guy by makeup, you know, I mean, in terms of like, there are people who are athletic or sturdy. I'm kind of like a weakling, like my health is not great. So I'm kind of surprised I took this path, but there was something in the unescapability. Like my first retreat I ever done was in Poland still when I was just at the end of high school. And I signed up for a 3 week long of this month long retreat. And the rule at that retreat was that you have to sit for each week that you'll be sitting, you'll go through this kind of cleansing period, so to speak. Like you have to sit the full day for each of the weeks that you'll sit. You'll have to sit a full day and you're kind of separate from the group. You don't take part in any activities. And the schedule basically is you sit for an hour and a half, then you have breakfast, then you sit for 3 hours, then you have lunch, then you sit for 4 hours straight, then you have dinner, and then you sit for an hour and a half, and then you can go to sleep. Which, you know, if someone is a meditator and tries to sit in a cross legs for that long, unless you're really well stretched and well equipped to that, it will be really challenging. It's really painful after some time.
God,
so
yeah.
That was my first retreat. And literally the day I came, they told me that from the next morning that will be the case. And even though it was, you know, it was really painful, you know, it was a hot summer and just like drenched in sweat, sitting there in pain. And yet, you know, through that process of they are not able to escape. There's just you, your mind, and that's it. And there was something in that confrontation that felt beneficial, even though it was really challenging. So I think that's why even though I knew, like even the place I was going to in Japan, even that teacher, Kwong Roshi, he was telling me like, I don't think you can handle that. Japan is a whole different game ball. You should really stay here. he kind of wasn't necessarily encouraging. But I had that feeling of, you know, that's where the path leads me. And I certainly don't think everybody should do that. It's not for everyone. And there are easier paths. So if you're not inclined, probably you're better off not taking it. But, you know, for some reason, I had that affinity. And training in Japan was pretty strict. It's kind of like almost Navy SEALs of spiritual world. I mean, of course, each tradition has some challenging aspects. But somehow the Japanese, I think there's also like slightly merging of that samurai culture and the spiritual culture that produces that sense of, you know, you need to really be tested in some way. And that testing is part of the process. So, for example, in the monastery, we didn't have any heating. If outside is 28 Fahrenheit, inside it'll be 28 Fahrenheit. And, you know, it can start snowing in November. And still, I remember in...
Can you wrap up in a big blanket?
Not in the meditation hall. In the meditation hall, you cannot wear hats, you cannot wear gloves, you cannot wear socks. Nothing can stick out from the robes.
And you can't have a blanket in addition to your robe.
You can sleep. At night, we had plenty of blankets. But it's a very different thing if you're like walking around and you know you'll come back to the warm place. But if you are really in that cold all the time, I sometimes use this kind of image of, it's like being in a stomach of a demon of cold that kind of slowly digests you, you know, because you get frostbites. Like the head monk, he was there from before I was born and he had some, you know, blood circulation problem, but he had literally all of his fingernails have fallen out
because of the frostbite.
So, you know, arriving there and seeing all that, you know, it definitely felt like people in Asia are just, their commitment is just so unwavering sometimes. And whether there's wisdom in exposing your body to harm, later on, I kind of rethought a lot of those things. But at the time, that's simply the way the tradition was transmitted. It was either you want to be there or you can do training elsewhere, but this is the way we do it. And just have to surrender to that.
Well, I have a couple of quick comments, and you probably will have comments on those. And one is that I know people who have had to have knee surgery because they forced their legs into some position they weren't ready to do, and they tore their meniscus and things like that. So people listening to this, be careful. And second thing is there have been many instances of newbies, you know, relatively inexperienced people plunging into some long, intense retreat where they're meditating all day long, who've flipped out. You know, they've had a psychotic episode and all. So you have to be really careful of that sort of thing, too. I mean, there's a place in Rhode Island called Cheetah House, run by someone named Willoughby Britton, that specializes in dealing with train wrecks that people have run into from trying to push too hard too fast. So that's just a cautionary.
Yeah, and definitely note. I agree fully with that. I had myself four knee surgeries, and the saying goes, it's better to start on a chair and end up in full lotus than start in full lotus and end up on chair. Not there's anything better with sitting on chair either way. You know what I mean? It's perfectly valid posture. There's a lot of, which I guess maybe we'll get in a little bit later, but the, you know, there's a lot of beliefs and ideas in the kind of very traditional Orthodox centers in the East that might not necessarily be that useful. And definitely our body is a vehicle for our mind, for our life, and we should not damage it without reason. And to be fair also is people in Japan live kneeling on the floor, right? Like their houses often don't have chairs. They have like a little tables at the floor level. So they are used to sitting on the ground much more than we are. So for them, it's not that much of a challenge. So it's not like, you know, Zen monasteries are just kind of torture institutions or anything. It's just for them, it's so much easier. And I happen to be 6 foot one and I wasn't stretched properly. It was just more challenging for me. And I was also not listening to my own body. So certainly it's not anything to be proud of. It's kind of stupidity, if anything, to kind of go against obvious signals from our body. But also to the other point, I would still say that about the, you know, breakdowns, I think that's a little bit of a role of a teacher. There are many retreats that I think one of them, I don't think it's like a big, I'm not saying it is a negative comment necessarily, but, you know, the Goenka retreats, right? Like the Vipassana Goenka retreats, there's simply, you know, there's like assistant teachers, but all the teachings are from the tapes. And there's you know, this very intense structure, and there's not enough guidance and support. You know, things can go south sometimes for people who might have some instability. But if there's a you know, wise guide around who can really see if a student actually is, you know, sort of fragile or something, and you know, they can really help with that and not to apply any more pressure and just kind of help them go through it.
And maybe not let them on the course in the first place if they don't pass some kind of psychological screening to, you know, show that they haven't been recently hospitalized for psychiatric issues or some such thing.
Sure. I mean, you know, I still feel like some larger conversation about that part probably is still clarifying itself among like, you know, the larger spiritual world. And there's still sometimes the belief in the East that like Dharma or like, you know, the kind of tradition is the best medicine for all the forms of suffering when it's not, right? Like, I mean, if there's a, sometimes in the West, if you meet like a really good trauma specialist, maybe they'll be way better for you at that moment if you have a lot of trauma than, let's say, the highest teaching that some great teacher could give you, right? So
there's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita which says, because one can perform it, one's own dharma, though lesser in merit, is better than the dharma of another. Better is death in one's own dharma. The dharma of another brings danger.
That's beautiful. I love it.
And the same goes with the psychedelic world. I mean, people have emergencies and catastrophes because of inadequate preparation or supervision in that arena.
Yeah. I fully agree. Yeah. So, you know, over there, I guess, you know, in my case, even though I did through the process, you know, some health damage was done, but yet I felt like in some other ways I was really suited to this life. I really loved this life. And I have to also mention my teacher, Tangen Harada Roshi, who was kind of, you know, I think it's fair to say it's kind of like Ramana Maharshi of Japan. You know what I mean? Like really very famous teacher that any person who met him, like I traveled in Japan quite a bit in different monasteries, and when people heard that he was my ordination teacher, you know, sometimes people would tear up and they would say like, oh, I encountered your teacher, you know, 30 years ago and it changed my life. And so many stories like that. Wherever I went, you know, I went to a different monastery for this kind of longer formal training, priest training. And the abbot there, when I said, you know, that my home temple is Bukkokuji and my teacher is Tangen Harada Roshi, he also, like, you know, teared up. And he told me this story when he traveled as a young monk, probably 25 years old, on some pilgrimage. And he heard of this great teacher and he wanted really to meet him. And you know, he came and, you know, listened to some Dharma talk and really was so impacted. And then they meditated in the evening and the sort of presence that was radiating from Tangen Roshi was just, you know, really touching him and moving him deeply. But he said what kind of really stayed with him the longest, or like it's still bringing him to tears, was that the next morning when he had to depart, he was traveling onwards to some other temple for ceremony. He woke up and in the morning he was about to leave and he saw that Tangen Roshi took his shoes and cleaned them because they were all muddy from travel and just put them neatly in front of his room. And he said it really just stayed with him and became like a treasure for him for all his life. So, you know, he was this kind of person who was just really kind of like, you know, we in Buddhism use this term bodhisattva, someone who really just lives to serve and lives to be for others. So.
Yeah, you wrote a book about him, which I read, and there were so many beautiful stories. Because, you know, you have the impression that in Zen, everybody's really strict and harsh mm-hmm. and mean and, you know, stuff like that. And this, he was a sweetie. I mean, maybe he had his strict side, but like little girl, her pet rabbit died and he got in his best robes and did a ceremony for the rabbit because mm-hmm. she asked him to. Or there was some kitten was sleeping on his seat and so he wouldn't sit on his seat because it meant mm-hmm. disturbing the kitten. You know, or another one was he was going on some trip and he had a bun that he was going to eat on the way. And when he opened it up to eat it, he discovered a cockroach was in there eating the bun. And so he very carefully, you know, he could have thrown it out the window or something, but he carefully put it aside and kept the cockroach safe. And he took it all the way with him to the trip and brought it home because he didn't want it to be separated from its little cockroach family. And then the cockroach came twice. He put it in a corner. The cockroach came twice mm-hmm. and bowed to him, you know, like, mm-hmm. thank you. And then went back with his little cockroach family. So I just thought it kind of revised my impression that, you know, there's not a lot of heart in Zen.
Yeah. And, you know, I have also practiced with some teachers who are a little bit more harsh. But yet I think, you know, I really feel this sort of, you know, two wings of one bird of wisdom and compassion. You know, I mean, like you need both to really be able to help people. If, you know, even if you have a great wisdom, if you're kind of cold and demanding and harsh, you know, it can just be not skillful, right? Or it cannot reach people's heart because they're kind of bracing themselves for the criticism. And also, you know, sometimes people have, you know, just tons of compassion and yet without the wisdom piece, right? Like saying yes to, let's say when you're raising a child, right? Saying yes to every single thing is not necessarily the wisest way to raise a child. So so I think, you know, that is something that I, you know, seeing in my teacher is stayed with me and, you know, obviously it's one of those things like living around those kind of great teachers of that sort of magnitude. It's, you know, it's kind of humbling in some way, right? Like, because you kind of, know how was the spectrum, right? Like what's possible. And I think, you know, this is a larger conversation too about, you know, I think it's extremely important to kind of deconstruct the myth of enlightenment, of awakening, that there is this, you know, mythological state somewhere that is reserved only for very few, and, you know, the special people, right? Like it's, you know, it was sold as that for many centuries, sometimes in different traditions. And, you know, these days, like even your podcast and, you know, other resources are really showing that actually it is available for everyone. But at the same,
That was one of my main motivations for starting it, because I live in a town where people have been meditating for decades and people were having profound awakenings, and they'd tell a friend and the friend wouldn't believe them because they're just an ordinary person, you know? And so I decided I'm going to start interviewing these people and show people that people like them could get awakened. And the subtitle of the show is Conversations with Ordinary Spiritually Awakening People.
Yeah. And I agree with that 100%. It's like every person, right, this ordinary person. Like, there's no more special or less special people. But yet at the same time, I still feel like, you know, sometimes in the process of that, there's this, you know, there is a danger, kind of the pendulum can swing a little bit too far to the other end. And, you know, just like in every field, let's say we have Michael Jordan in basketball and we have Tiger Woods in golf. And it's not like everybody should aspire to be Michael Jordan, right? You know, people can play basketball beautifully and help impoverished kids to not to get into trouble. Like I was getting into trouble, you know, through basketball and other things. So there are so many good things that can happen. And yet, you know, I'm just only saying it because, you know, in the Buddhist world, it's never part of conversation, but sometimes I feel like in a kind of online, secular non-duality, there's a little bit of that, you know, someone has one glimpse and they hear the teaching of there's nothing to do. There's no, it's already here. And therefore there's no need for any further, practice or further maturation or further clarification. And yet, you know, only when we see people who, you know, truly we're kind of, far along that spectrum, we can see like, oh, wow, there is actually more to be clarified. There is more to embody, right? Like with Thangdrong Rinpoche, that was the thing. Like, his whole physical incarnation felt, you know, somehow sacred, right? Even though he was, you know, he was a chubby Japanese man. But yet there was something radiant about his presence that was truly moving. And people were, you know, there are people who every time they saw him, they cried, or, you know, there was this woman from the neighborhood who was like having horrific insomnia to the point that she was really struggling with the mental health. And she started to come, to once a month to talks by this kind of public talk that Roshi would give for villagers. And Roshi was always like laughing, oh, like, you know, my talks can make sleep even an insomnia. but she was helped, you know, she was just literally falling asleep as soon as she was in his presence. And then through that, you know, she got better with sleep on her own too. So there were some mysterious ways in which his presence could work. And it was just inspiring and humbling, you know.
That's nice. Yeah, here's a quote from my notes. The Thangdrong insisted that even great awakening requires, quote, ever still more polishing. Buddhahood as an ongoing process, not a finished product. And there's so many stories about that. And you're right. I mean, Neo-Advaita, as it's called, says this thing of, oh, you're already enlightened and you don't need to do anything. And on some level, that's true. But practically speaking, it's not true, because on some level the universe never manifested, fine, but we're involved in a universe, and don't go stepping in front of buses because you think it never manifested.
Definitely. I feel like, you know, there are many analogies that I think are good here. One is that, you know, the old one about the man going back to his home and seeing a snake coiled in, you know, in a corner, and it's freaking out having this fear response, and only later kind of coming with the light and seeing it was actually a rope coiled there, right? So is this true that snake never need to be thrown from the house? Like, it's not that the man will ever get rid of the snake. The whole premise of the, you know, the whole thing is false. But at the same time, fear was real. His fear response was real. So as long as we are suffering from sense of separation, from illusion, you know, what is there good to hear that, you know, you don't need to be afraid of the snake. You have to actually come with the light of your own seeing and see clearly the reality of the situation. There's just a rope there. But as long as you don't know that, you know, sure, the insistence of snake is not true, it, you know, it's all good, but unless the seeing happens, the suffering is ongoing. So, you know, that's...
I've heard there's a Tibetan Buddhist saying that don't mistake understanding for realization, and don't mistake realization for liberation. And, you know, it's actually kind of cruel to go to a person who's confused and suffering and, you know, all kinds of traumas and whatnot and say, oh, you're fine just as you are. You're already enlightened. Mm-hmm. That'll be $10, please. Whatever.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm not like too deeply. I actually, you know, until the pandemic, I never owned my own computer. I never had bank account. I never had any social media. So I'm really kind of new to the game, but it was interesting to kind of like enter this digital marketplace and sort of see even the comments that people leave on spiritual, you know, videos that are kind of like, you know, sometimes so harsh and so kind of judging, opinionated, or just, you know, some of this kind of insistence for certain teachings. And it kind of has that undertone of just finding a new identity club and sort of defending it just as you defend your religious or political position, which, you know, is just so far from, you know, the actual living experience of it, which contains paradox always. Yeah. Like it contains multitude, right? It's never one-sided.
So after everything you've been through now so far, what is your best understanding of what enlightenment actually is? And feel free to take as much time as you want to answer, and we'll go back and forth on it for a little while.
You know, it's one of those things that you almost like have to define terms before even responding, right? But again, I don't think I use, you know, there's terms of like awakening, realization, enlightenment, liberation. And, you know, some people might use them interchangeably entirely. I feel like just because, in my own unfolding and seeing it in other people, it seems to me that, for most people, it would go in a certain, it doesn't come in one single strike. There's an initial recognition, which I would call awakening probably, like.
Is that what they call Kensho?
Yes. So Kensho literally means seeing nature, right? So you kind of see the nature of your mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I could say, you know, I could divide it into, let's say, roughly three categories, or like three stages, one could say. First one would be recognizing the nature of mind, right? So it's simply, initially we are just so identified with the content and, you know, the body and mind, basically, right? The content of mind and this body is me. Everything else is not me, right? So it's, one could say that the central piece here is kind of identity, right? Like, what do we take ourselves to be? So initially, the sort of my thoughts are defining, our kind of statements of truth are defining my reality. And I see the world, even if I can't recognize it in a moment, we can see it mostly as usually with those shifts. We kind of see things in a rearview mirror, what kind of is gone, rather than we, you know, it's more difficult to recognize it beforehand, but we see the world through elaborate kind of a spider web of thoughts, right? Of different beliefs. Let's say if I
filters, exactly, conditioning. Yeah.
So if I think kind of myself, I'm a bad person, you know, my interaction will be seen through my own actions and actions of others towards me will be seen through that lens. I might have some other, different lens. Like, you know, it's a kind of, it's not even one coherent view, right? Like ego, the mind identification is kind of a little bit fractured, one could say. It's many pieces that kind of, you know, I guess maybe the internal family systems are kind of trying to, you know, point to that, right? There are different parts of ourselves and they have different needs, sometimes different psychological age. And, you know, there's, but as long as we're identifying with the content of our mind, we're constantly at the mercy of that movement of content of thought. So then there can happen this recognition that actually the content itself is simply like a movie projected on the screen, right? And yet there is a light that makes that projection possible. So the whole field of consciousness, it almost like wakes up, right? It sort of, it's recognition of its own nature, right? So it's not necessarily that even the small I is recognizing something or becoming an awakened self. It's more that the true nature of mind, which is, at least experientially, it feels like it's timeless, unlimited, undestructible. And I can, I can perfectly understand why someone would, use the language more of like a, kind of God, word, right?
Yeah. And when you say that true nature of mind, mm-hmm. timeless, unlimited, undistractable, are you really referring to mind, which usually means a more sort of mm-hmm. agitated, active level, or are you referring to that which underlies and illuminates the mind, consciousness
itself? Yeah. So ultimately, there is no difference. But initially, we have to, of course, disidentify with the layer of content and then see the nature of it, the under, as you said, underlying thing.
Yeah. Like see the movie screen that the movies are playing.
But yet later we also see that, even the nature of even that movement of confusion is in itself the same, has the same nature as the whole field. But initially we need to kind of disidentify from that. So there's like, sometimes there can be this moment of kind of stepping back, seeing as content is just content, and some people experience the sort of witness stage, but ultimately, in my experience, that is also that is also a duality that gets sort of transcended or healed or seen through, however you want to phrase it.
And there's that same so that's model in Hindu thought too, that you go into a witnessing phase and then later on there's more mm-hmm. unification and kind of a unity consciousness thing. It's more universal understanding. So the word enlightenment itself has a kind of a static superlative connotation, mm-hmm. like, oh, you've reached the end, you're enlightened, you can just sit back and relax. But as we were saying earlier, your teacher and others have said, no, there's no end to it. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be some refinement, some polishing, some deepening, some clarification or something. So would you agree with that there's no end? And we might explore if you've realized pure consciousness, can you really improve upon that? And if not, then what is there left to refine or clarify or mm-hmm. purify?
Yeah. So no, I definitely agree that just that recognition, and this is important point, I feel that very often those shifts, let's say that, recognition of the nature of mind, right? They have very often a flavor of this is it. This is the final thing. And it kind of can feel it as if, okay, I got it. Now that's the full enchilada. And yet, in a rearview mirror, we see so many times like, oh, actually, there is something completely different revealed later. So I think it's important to note that, even if it feels final and it fills us with kind of self-confidence, sometimes in Zen it's called the Zen stink. Like you kind of smell of that kind of fresh awakening that you sort of preach to every single person you meet, how free you are and how deluded they are, whatever, so this is like a first thing, the sort of awakening. And I would say that later, depending, some people go through like a honeymoon phase and there can be a lot of bliss and it feels wonderful and rather complete. And I certainly spent, after my kind of second really big awakening, I spent a couple of years in bliss and sort of just, it was just, it was awesome, but there was almost like this sense of like intuition, there's still something more to see. So after, after the sort of initial.
This would actually be a good opportunity. You mentioned you had three breakthroughs at 23, 30, mm-hmm. and 37. Maybe you could tell us about each of those breakthroughs and use that to elaborate on this concept of what mm-hmm. enlightenment actually is.
Yeah. So the initial one, was just that recognizing the nature of consciousness itself. It's a pure being. It has nothing, it has no quality. I mean, I guess the Satchit Ananda, right, is the term in Hindu or in Sanskrit, which is used. And it
existence, consciousness, bliss.
Which I think it's pretty spot on. There's this feeling of pure being, right, that has almost no qualities but bliss and pure beingness, right? It's just that most fundamental sense of being, and it feels, you know, it feels beyond time, and it feels just, it was never touched, you know, whatever was unfolding in our lives and whatever challenge we experienced, you know, that thing was never harmed. And that's why it's so liberating and it's so freeing. And, you know, some people would call it the sort of up and out movement of awakening, right? It's sort of, because it can feel like that. So in my own awakening, there was this, in that moment, it was this sort of movement that started to like almost go up and out. Literally, that's how it felt. And you know, I remember very clearly this sort of, it was during a retreat. I was laying in bed, and I couldn't sleep for really, you know, days and days and days. It was just this sort of golden field of presence enveloping me. And there was this kind of...
Ah, now let me just ask a question there. So was your body actually sleeping, but your consciousness was awake? Or do you think your body was even awake?
It's also hard to make distinction there.
Because there is this phenomenon of witnessing sleep. You know, you could be snoring like a drunken sailor, but your inner awareness is pure and clear, and you haven't lost consciousness.
You know, I was definitely hearing the breath, but it felt, you know, the wakefulness of the radiant golden field was just so prominent that, I think it was probably borderline. I don't think I was deep, you know, deep asleep, but because the trigger was, I was somewhat aware of the body.
And how long did this go on? This period?
I was actually on this 90-day long retreat, and you know, for several weeks I was going to sleep, and I mean, I was trying to go to sleep, and then it was just this sort of like, you know, felt like timeless presence that was just primary, and everything else was just very kind of distant background. But
and did you feel tired during the day?
Maybe slightly, like the biologically, the energetic body was pretty radiant and bright, but the biological body was, you know, but it was all right. It wasn't, you know, and then it was actually, it was a summer, and I was laying kind of somewhere on my side, and it was dark. So I, you know, and I had very distorted sense of space also. And I touched with my hand something on my back, and it was first time I learned that I grew some hair on my back. So it kind of like felt like in an odd place, suddenly there's this touch and I feel some hair there. And there's this sort of almost like a stroboscope of, you know, because you can feel both on your skin on the back, and you can feel in your, so there's this sort of subject object was kind of flipping back and forth like a stroboscope, because like both were trying to figure out what did it encounter, in some way. And then there was this moment of cessation, which when everything disappeared. And from there, it felt as if from the depths of my belly was this movement that initiated. And then it kind of came up and sort of started this explosion of subtle body that, there was this sort of liberating movement of kind of up and out all the time. It was really interesting. I only later heard that Papaji used to say that he can really clearly see each time a person has awakening, because the subtle body explodes in a fireworks. And I felt like, oh wow, that's really precisely how I would describe it. That it was, and sometimes those seeing kind of, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas sort of in those cascades of kind of fireworks of a subtle body that was kind of ongoing for a couple of weeks, which was,
you were seeing,
I mean, it was not like, because they were kind of around here, but yeah, there was this, I don't know if it was an eye seeing, it was more like a mind's eye seeing or
inner mind's eye, of course. Yeah. I wasn't suggesting your physical eyes. And so it sounds like a kind of a classic Kundalini awakening.
You know, I had Kundalini awakening later, and it was very different in nature, it felt to me, and actually it was pretty challenging, the Kundalini thing later, but in that moment, that whole space of consciousness, it almost like, you know, awoke and felt like liberated, almost like, you know, it's obviously the experiential byproducts of awakening are not awakening itself. It's not what's important in awakening, but it's almost like you have a bottle of champagne and you shake it because of the pressure. If you put it, it's like, boom, you know, it starts to flow, right? But what's important is the taste of champagne. Yeah. Obviously, it's not the foam. So it will settle. But initially, because the mind identification, the sort of contraction inherent in the sort of view of separate self, when it explodes, it can be just so, you know, yeah, exactly. It's just thrusting and therefore there's this up and out movement. So this is like, I would say the first awakening, right?
That was the 23-year-old one.
I kind of don't want to mix it too much here. There was an earlier one that I had at 23. This one was at when I was 30, but there was still one at 33 and 37. I don't want to like bore with too many details here.
No, it's not boring. This is interesting. I don't really have any questions on that one. It just sounds like a beautiful experience. Well, I guess one question is, was this on a retreat that this happened? And this is after, if this happened when you were 30, you had been doing intense practice for over a decade.
Yeah.
So it had built up to this.
Definitely, yeah. So the first awakening I had was with my teacher, and it was, and actually, you know, most of them, I have to say, it wasn't like a, you know, victory sort of, a situation was mostly failure, right? So I think it's really kind of accurate to say that awakening is not winning, it's losing. You know, you really lose to the schedule, you lose right. to your teacher, you lose, you're just in a complete defeat, and then something can really show up. And again, maybe for other people it's going differently, so I'm not necessarily having a strong opinion how it should feel. For me, I certainly felt like I was defeated. So the first, you know, the sort of initial breakthrough was when I was, it was very cold. It was a December retreat, and I was really thin because, the monastery food wasn't that much. And there was just this continuous pressure, and people are hitting with the stick. If you move this way or that way, they immediately get hit. There's people walking behind you all the time, right? Like it's continuous sort of patrolling and,
do you take turns being the stick person?
We'll take turn in that. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. And then, you know, I was just like trying to concentrate my mind like into this sort of samadhi state. And I was just feeling.
Would you get headaches? I mean, would it kind of like, it seems to me it would be such a strain.
Eventually, when I kind of, had some breakthrough, it certainly felt very easy in some ways. But initially, yeah, I think there's a little bit of that kind of sense of intensity. Yeah.
I know in Ajay's case, he was like a gung-ho. He was a competitive bicycle racer, and he brought the same competitive spirit to his spiritual practice. And he reached a point at which he felt like, I'm going to go crazy if I push any further. And so he kind of went to his little backyard hut and had this attitude of, I'm giving up. And then boom, he had his big awakening.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. I for me, it was like, because the Buddha's Enlightenment Week in Japanese monasteries is the most intense. You sleep even less. Some monasteries, you actually have to give away your bedding, so you don't lay down for the whole week, right? Like it's this sort of intense retreat, and I was just like trying and yet feeling like I was failing. So it was a 7-day long retreat, and every day everybody was going to dinner at like 5 p.m. But because I was hitting the big temple bell, I had to stay in the meditation hall, and I ate after everybody finished eating. So I was just sitting there at night, you know, when everybody left, and I was, you know, every day, first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day. And I was just constantly being defeated, and felt like I was just trying to push away this sort of karma and confusion, vasanas and all that. And I was just like struggling. And it was the seventh day, so the last day of retreat, and it was evening time. Everybody left the meditation hall, and I was waiting for the meditation to ring the meditation bell. And at some point, there was exactly that realization of like, I just can't do it. It's just too much. And I said, I welcome all the confusion, everything, may it come. And then there was this kind of movement that started to happen of, kind of like initially it was just the thoughts that I had, and later it was almost like memories from my childhood. And it was very kind of fast kind of movement. And then at some point it was also like different, almost like a momentary experiencing of scenes from lives. You know, I mean, one could interpret it as a past lives, but regardless, it was just like a woman grieving its baby, or from the first person perspective, right? Or like a knight being cut by a sword, or like, you know, all those kind of images flashing. Yeah. And at some point, kind of they start to be more and more transparent, and there's just this pure stillness like I have never experienced before. Wow. In my whole life.
Didn't something like that happen to the Buddha too? On his awakening, he remembered all his past lives and then broke through. You know better than me, but I think I remember that story.
there are many different telling of that story depending on which tradition. So I didn't right. necessarily remember that bit. Yeah,
but I've heard that in various true. Yogis and whatnot. Yeah. They have this whole purging and kind of like a slideshow of many past lives at the moment of their big yeah. liberation.
Yeah. So. You know, that was the first kind of breakthrough that I had. And I want to like say that in the context of the whole, you know, talking about realization and its unfoldment, I'm pretty sure that many teachers in the West in the Zen sort of tradition in the West would probably say like, okay, you had your awakening. Now you should work on subsequent koans or, you know, now you should kind of do kind of more refining work. And yet, you know, my teacher, he wasn't this kind of guy who would just like easily, pass people. So he would, you know, he definitely acknowledged, he said like, oh, your eyes are so shining. You're a treasure. But he was now, you know, really have to continue. And he just rang a bell to kind of dismiss me. And so even though, you know, there was a lot of qualities that were feeling like, you know, my experience felt centerless. I didn't feel kind of located at the center of universe anymore. There was this spaciousness and openness and things. And yet I felt, you know, I just followed to his guidance that I kind of keep still doing the sort of practice that had a little bit of a flavor of an effort. And even though, you know, I think there is something to be said for, you know, transition from effortful to effortless practice. I think it's a natural transition in many people's spiritual life, and I certainly experienced that. But at that point, so here's like a little sort of working model that maybe I'll hear your thoughts about. So there's this kind of horizontal axis that I would say stages of realization, right? Still later in this discussion into the further ones, but you know, the initial awakening and then maybe that sort of collapse of what seems to be like, let's say, pure awareness and the objects, right, into this kind of more non-duality. And then, you know, some further clarifications. And yet I still feel that there is also another axis, which is the axis of depth. And that axis, you know, it's, I rarely hear it acknowledged, but, you know, there can be recognition of the same awakening, right? The same nature of mind. And yet there can be qualitative difference of how permeating one's incarnation, one's humanity, it is. So let's say, you know, someone like Eckhart Tolle, for example, right? Who got to just blast it out of blue from, you know, really horrific depression into this world of kind of open wakefulness. You know, he spent several years just sitting on the bench, just being mesmerized by the beauty of life. And you know, I feel like maybe he was just really on this axis of depth, you know, for whatever karmic reasons, it really plunged him pretty deeply. And sometimes there is like a sense of, I kind of feel certain pockets of modern sort of spiritual landscape, especially online, where kind of YouTube channels sometimes try to like promote the sort of instant awakening sessions and sort of, it's almost like this little pointing and kind of like trying to talk people into like, you see, everything is awake, everything is right. And yet, you know, it feels sort of that realization is not kind of going into the depths to which, you know, I mean, there's a spectrum there, right? So I feel yeah. like there's this sort of 2D, and then, you know, one could, if we want to like make it even more sort of comprehensive, there's maybe like a 3D axis, another axis that would be how much of our vasanas and how much of our obscurations, or like how much our humanity is transformed, which I would say that, you know, it is a related axis to both others. And probably the more you are kind of at the deep end of both, that axis by itself probably for most people is kind of has to go along, but it's not necessarily synonymous, right? The sort of idea that enlightenment or awakening or realization bestows upon us some perfect moral behavior or, you know, all that. It's, you know, we learned it the hard way enough already that it's not necessarily true. And I was made aware just recently of your work with the Association for Spiritual Integrity, which I think it's really great because, you know, right, especially these days, it's, you know, we don't have that much. It's almost like a Wild West right now with the spiritual teachings in the West because, you know, therapists, they have very clear sort of guidelines. What's the proper relationship with the client? What's not okay? And you know, what was proved to be a sketchy territory, right? And in the East, there's a little bit more, I mean, depending on the country, but still there's this kind of framework of morality and how monks, let's say, are kind of expected to behave and, you know, but yet I think there's this kind of new, young thing being born, which is completely secular spirituality. And yet the rules are kind of not laid out too clearly. And there's a lot of room for, you know, for mess up.
Yeah, I have a lot to say on this topic, so I'll say a little bit, but I don't want to say too much because I want you to be doing most of the talking here. But I think it's possible to have an experiential breakthrough without it actually influencing, like you said, all your vasanas and your hang-ups and your traumas and your whole makeup. There can be a breakthrough. And there's several different useful models. One is Ken Wilber's lines of development model, where he talks about, you know, we have all these different things, intellect and heart and senses and consciousness and a number of other ones. And the consciousness line can have a breakthrough and get quite developed, yet the other ones are really quite immature still. And he advocates the holistic maturation of all of them. And I used to think, and my former teacher used to say, that they're all tightly correlated. If you attain samadhi, then all the other aspects of your personality are going to come along, kind of like dragging one leg of a table and the rest of the table, all the other legs are going to come. But in practice, I have not seen that pan out. Either with him or with many, many other people who were highly developed in the consciousness line, but really problematic in many other lines. So I don't think it's automatic. And I think it requires diligence and attention to bring all the other ones into line. A line from one of the Carlos Castaneda books, Don Juan says, a warrior has time only for his impeccability. Mm. And there's a great line from Padmasambhava, who said, although my awareness is as vast as the sky, my attention to karma is as fine as a grain of barley flour. Mm-hmm. I heard one popular, I wasn't there, but I heard that one popular spiritual teacher said, if you think awakening has anything to do with ethics, then you don't understand awakening. And I disagree with that because, I mean, if you can be an alcoholic and a sexual abuser and all kinds of other things and yet be supposedly enlightened, I don't want that kind of enlightenment. You can have it, you know? I want the kind that actually involves holistic development and refinement of all aspects of life so that you become a compassionate, ethical, you know, good person, not just someone who claims to have some profound inner experience and is acting like an asshole. So anyway, that's probably enough for me. You could comment on that.
No, I fully agree. And I think, you know, traditions, we're kind of aware of that. And again, there are certainly people coming out of those traditions who are not also behaving in the best way. So, maybe it's sort of, you know, it's definitely the case that everybody should be vigilant. But, you know, I think the sort of older traditions, like Buddhism and Hinduism, they had some understanding about those traps, right? And for example, in Zen, you know, it's, let's say when you are, you had the breakthrough and then you kind of, let's say if you are working with koans, after the initial breakthrough koan, which is supposed to kind of bring you to awakening, the second koan in that collection, for example, is the famous koan about the fox, right? Which means it's a long story, but basically it's the sort of teacher is giving Dharma talk and the fox is kind of coming and the teacher is asking the fox, like, why did you come here? And fox saying, I was a monk 500 years ago, and I was a teacher, and someone asked me whether a person who is enlightened is free from cause and effect, which means karma. And he said, I responded that you are completely beyond cause and effect, and therefore I was reborn 500 years as a fox. So it's kind of like the second thing after...
Because in other words, he committed a boo-boo by misinforming
the
person.
But it's just like, those are all pointers, okay. But they say, like, you know, first thing you should learn after awakening is like, it doesn't take you off the hook of being responsible for your actions, right? And then even towards the end process of learning, you kind of revisit precepts, which are the kind of moral rules that, you know, one should abide by. And So I think traditionally it was kind of more understanding. And also, like, if you live, let's say, in a monastery, right? And, you know, everybody is seeing how you behave, which is kind of like the safety net, because it's like living in this big family of, you know, let's say 25, 30 people. And even if you feel like, oh, you know, I'm the Mr. Enlightenment now. And meanwhile, you get the mirror is right in front of your face, right? Like, everybody's reflecting back to you how you behave. So it's kind of more, you know, there's some,
marriage will do that for you too.
Yeah, no, sure, exactly. So I think it's good to have, you know, safety nets, peer groups, or you know, like some people that kind of hold you accountable, and they don't look up to you, and they don't think you're the new coming of Christ. And you know, to be perfectly honest, like I do feel like the line of work of trying to kind of explain teach spirituality, you know. Either you're kind of just like, you know, life is sort of naturally forcing you to do it, but at the same time, there's a percentage of people who have narcissistic personality traits who are just drawn to be in those positions. And, you know, maybe they have some glimpse, some taste, and maybe they have charismatic personality, but, you know, it's good to really be discerning. And if something doesn't feel right, most likely it's not right. You know, it's sort of bullshit detector should be on at all times, I feel. Yeah.
Good points. Yeah, I mean, there are many people who have suggested that narcissists are drawn to becoming spiritual teachers, maybe in the way that pedophiles are drawn to being priests. I don't know. But that, you know, because you get all this praise and adulation, everybody thinks you're wonderful. And a lot of spiritual teachers don't have a lot of peers. They're busy teaching, and it's just them and their students. You know, and the students tend to adulate them and to kind of allow them to get away with stuff because they think that they're supposed to be enlightened. And even though it seems crazy and weird, well, who am I to say because he's enlightened and I'm not? So,
That's the most kind of challenging thing to overcome, right? Because, you know, there is some power in kind of inhabiting this archetype of priest or guru or whatever. You know, people project a lot, and that movement of mind that says, like, you know, it doesn't feel right, and yet they are the enlightened one and I am the unenlightened one, therefore, you know, I'm sure they know better. And of course the group dynamic around the teacher, and everybody is kind of like reinforcing that, and you don't want to be out of line and say, like, you know what, this doesn't feel that good to me. It is a tricky dynamic. Yeah. And then, you know, hopefully, you know, with time, we kind of, as a culture, figured out that a little bit better. And I think there are, like, you know, major kind of, incidents kind of in the 70s and 80s. And I think, you know, slowly, hopefully.
Oh, and now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you probably know more about those things just because of your work and how many people you interact with. So,
right.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's very, I think it's very important part of this whole discussion. So.
Yeah. And one of our goals with ASI is not only to give teachers a code of ethics or tenets that they might want to aspire to live up to, but also to empower students to be more confident in their own discernment and discrimination. And if they, there's this saying with regard to like terrorist situations, if you see something, say something. It kind of applies in this arena also. You know, don't assume that you're just an unenlightened dummy if you see something inappropriate happening. Say something or leave or, you know, respond in some concrete way.
Definitely. Yeah. So maybe just going back to that whole, you know, trajectory of awakening and the timeline. So
yes.
So with my own unfolding, you know, I spent with Thangdin Harada Roshi for as long as he taught, and he had pneumonia in 2012, so he couldn't teach after that. And after that, I was just, you know, traveling different monasteries and studying with different teachers. And you know, there's.
Did you learn Japanese, by the way?
Yeah. So
you
could. I speak Japanese.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah.
So I think, you know, having have met person of that caliber, and I feel, you know, it's one of those things, and that it's easy to sort of, at the time, I had just this view that probably the enlightened people are just this dinosaur race that is kind of dying out, and there's no one else left because, you know, seeing, you know, traveling to different temples, and I yet didn't encounter someone as impressive as him. And I think there's a little bit of that, you know, there can be that tendency and that danger, especially in like more traditional paths, that there's kind of sort of mythologizing and putting on a pedestal the past teachers and thinking how, you know, extraordinary they were, and kind of thinking this almost like the age of decay of Dharma. And I certainly had a little bit of that view. And actually, you know, your podcast was one of point of reference that was kind of helpful, because I guess I left that monastery probably around the time when you were starting your show. So and then, you know, at some point someone was sending me some links. I was like, oh, you know, that's really interesting to kind of see those interviews with regular people who, you know, didn't necessarily had those super dramatic life stories like my teacher had and all that. So then I went to this other monastery, and there was this teacher who I thought he will be kind of just like my teacher. And I was just having these big hopes and sort of, because he was very impressive in some way. And I went to this monastery, and that Zen master was just so harsh. He was this, you know, also old Japanese, man, but he was just very demanding, very harsh, very cold. There was none of that connection that I had with my first teacher. And I felt like almost, you know, just in the corner without escape and not being able to connect with him too much, and yet feeling like maybe he's my last chance for, you know, doing some serious practice. And he would still kind of send me, even though I had already one knee surgery, he would send me to, like, you know, in the Zen monastery, sometimes you have to carry shit, you know what I mean? Like you scoop out shit because you all your poop and pee
from the latrine
is going to a tank underneath it, and then you basically scoop it to those big buckets,
right,
which are like, you know, I don't know, 20 gallon buckets that you kind of like carry out and just like either use it on the fields or something. So it's not something you can do with you know, meniscus problems.
Knees.
And he was kind of kept sending me to those, and then also this was a temple where there was both men and women, and he made me work, like, as made me this young girl. I mean, I was a young boy, so it wasn't, but she was like, you know, my age, let's say we were 30. He made her my assistant to do some particular temple function, and something started to happen between us. And I was, you know, at the time I was celibate and had whole identity wrapped around being celibate monk. So things were just like breaking down, and I felt like I just can't stay there, even though he, you know, he was impressive. You know, he could really, he was one of those people who really could perceive something about your mind without any interaction. Like you'd ring the bell, you would go inside, you would bow in front of him, and you would just do one exhale. And he would start to speak, and he could literally like start commenting on the exact thoughts you had right in that moment when you were entering the room, right? He was very perceptive in that way, but yet he was very cold. He was very like looking at the chink in your armor and just like shooting an arrow there that would be kind of hurtful in some way. So through that process, I felt like I was getting crushed down and crushed down, and I left the monastery. I went to work in a hospice that he created. So I was just taking care of dying people and sort of kind of reconciling that whole thing. And then from there, I went for the retreat that I just mentioned, where I just had these experiences during the sleep and all that. So I felt it was almost like, again, I kind of came to the place where I kind of felt, okay, I failed and there's no room forward. And yet through that, right, there was some flowering that happened that couldn't have happened when my will was constantly, you know, directing every single movement that I was doing. So, you know, that was really interesting. And then, you know, past that, I was kind of traveling different. After that, I also got involved with Adyashanti. I started to go for his retreats. And I really connected with him and felt like he was, you know, he was extraordinarily clear, and he, you know, his presence was really beautiful too. So it felt actually very healing for me to meet him, because he was a Westerner. At some point, I had all sorts of stupid ideas, but I had idea that almost maybe only those Asians were just like so hardcore motivated. Maybe they are the only ones who can get it, and we wimps in the West can't and whatnot. So meeting Adya and, you know, the California guy and, you know, just a regular person in some ways, and yet, you know, very clear teacher, was really healing. And through that, you know, I felt like this second movement of first is up and out, right? And then the second one is almost like down and in. So you know, the sort of we can hang out for as long as we want in the sort of sense of transcendence and pure glory of consciousness. It's just, you know, it's blissful. It's never hurt. It's complete. It's always complete. That was the most prominent quality that I felt through that awakening. When the, you know, fireworks subsided, there was this sense before, whenever I looked at my experience, I could always improve it. I could always be more in samadhi. I could always do something. I always wanted to have something better than this right now. And after that, there was just this sense of completeness, as if the original sin was taken away. Like finally, like just sitting in, just sitting was bliss in itself. There was nothing to be done. There was nothing to accomplish. But yet, you know, when that sort of initial intoxication with the transcendence kind of comes to an end, there is a sense that you could kind of like almost hide all your life there. And I feel, you know, there are certain maybe styles of teaching that really emphasize that aspect, and they feel like this is the end of the trajectory, and you should just like, you know, spread your camp there and never leave. And yet there is something, you know, some people might not experience it in that way, but there feels something dualistic there, which means there is a consciousness or awareness or however you want to call it. And then there's all the objects in the world, right? And they feel somewhat separate. There feels like one is a container and then everything else is arising within it. But yet it is still a duality, right? So then there is a kind of moment of collapse, which kind of requires certain almost like willingness to be vulnerable, because it's, you know, the sort of eternal witness is untouched. And yet when we see that actually the two are never separate, and I think that's the, you know, the three statements of Shankara, right? The, you know, the world is illusion, Brahman alone is real, but then the world is Brahman, right? That realization needs to happen. And then you kind of revisit, you know, conditioning and your humanity, which, as just we discussed, it's not, you know, immediately blown away with the awakening. And then we kind of revisit the sort of, you know, all of parts of ourselves that were repressed or you know, some shadow material that maybe was kind of lingering that we were not willing to see because we were just so fascinated and in love with the bliss of self, with the capital S, let's say, that we're kind of unwilling to bring it down, right? Kind of like the, you know, the archetype of Jesus, right? That love, that God loved the world so much that it kind of given it its only son. It kind of became, the word became the flesh. And, you know, the flesh is messy, right? The flesh can experience suffering and be hanged on the cross. And you know, all that comes with the reconnecting with the very human aspect of ourselves. But what's also important, I feel, in that what's experiential, also the difference between the first sort of awakening and that realization, is that it brings even deeper intimacy. Because the difference is that, at least that was my experience, that initially when there's this sense of you know, pure being and consciousness, there's still a sense that there is subject here, even though there is a sense that, you know, it's all consciousness. In terms of perception, there is a sense of a seer here that looks at objects out there. And only when the sort of the second movement of down and in and collapse of the apparent difference between awareness and its content happens, then there's like profound intimacy with everything, because there is no, that division, that separation of subjects and objects is completely gone. And therefore, there's just this completely alive, completely intimate experience that is unfolding. And it has, you know, it has experientially very different quality to that previous awakening.
Yeah. I have a couple of thoughts on this. Firstly, what you were saying about awakening being so fulfilling, you could just sit there forever and just bask and marinate in that, and why do anything else? It reminds me of a story of Vivekananda when he had his awakening and he went to Sri Ramakrishna and he said, oh, this is just wonderful. Now just let me go to the Himalayas and just sit in the cave and enjoy this for the rest of my life. And Ramakrishna said, I'm so disappointed in you. I expected you to do something with this. And so then he did. He became very active. And in fact, Vivekananda said at one point, he said, I don't care about liberation in which I never come back. I'll be happy to come back, like a bodhisattva thing. I'll be happy to come back thousands of times to help the world. And then the second thing that it reminded me of is that I think this separation phase that you've described is perhaps a prerequisite to further phases, in that until you've kind of separated, you know, self from non-self, you can't really progress in terms of the full refinement of the non-self world. It enables you to experience degrees of refinement which wouldn't be possible if the self weren't realized, if pure consciousness weren't realized. And this could involve refinement of perception. And also, I think pure consciousness can act like a solvent, where if we have all these embedded vasanas and whatnot in our systems, once pure consciousness is realized, in spite of those vasanas, they don't last long in the light of that, or at least they're challenged, you know, and exposed to something which is going to tend to dissolve them. And then there's the whole question of God, which is not really much discussed in Buddhism, but I believe there's a phase, or at least in the Vedic tradition, there's a phase where God consciousness becomes a possibility, where there is such a thing as God and you actually can realize it experientially, but not unless you have first established the self. As my former teacher once said, without having established that foundation, God couldn't even telephone you from a distance. You'd be crushed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I would need to read more descriptions of that, because I could see how that realization of, you know, let's call it self with capital S, true self, right? How that could be called God. I mean, all the qualities are there. I mean, it feels indestructible, eternal, limitless, and all that. So I say, you know, sometimes it's a matter of semantics. And I fully agree. I think the jump from the sort of small separate self immediately to the sort of no self territory probably will be pretty destabilizing and pretty, a lot. So there's like this stepping stone that needs to happen. And for most people, I'm sure there are people for whom it happened. And I think you have a first row seat to how many different ways that things can happen in this arena. But I think for most people, there is actually some, first step and then kind of further step.
Yeah, there are stages. Almost everybody goes through stages.
Yeah.
My understanding of God, which is, it could be put in terms of what you said about the self, is that if we look at any little thing in creation, a cell in a blade of grass or in our own body or anything, there's this miracle of incredible complexity and creativity happening. And the whole universe is packed solid with countless trillions of those little miracles, that the whole thing is just one solid mass of intelligence. And so for me, the idea of just the realization of plain vanilla pure consciousness is not ultimate. I have also the desire to more deeply appreciate that omnipresent intelligence that's running the whole show. To be one with that and to know that intimately. That's my sense of God. Obviously not some guy with a beard hanging out on a cloud, that kind of thing.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's, reality is limitless. And this sort of realization has endless depths, right? It's ongoing exploration. And the sooner we kind of stop thinking about finish lines in this whole project, the more we just are able to appreciate the crazy ride that it is. And there's so many different things that can be, that, can come to our consciousness and can come to our realization, the whole spectrum. So, certainly it's sometimes, I think there's some value in sort of, narrowing it down for the sake of one-pointedness when let's say communicating to let's say someone who is interested in realizing the first thing, then sometimes we can just sort of hammer it away and sort of focus on that. But
definitely, I mean, you don't study quantum mechanics when you're in second grade or something, you get to that later.
So then I would say there is another kind of shift, at least that's how my own trajectory was, which is a little bit more difficult to verbalize, because, as with every shift, I mean, some of the shifts are more, I would say, more kind of like dramatic when they unfold and all that. But yet the important piece almost is often what is not there afterwards. Like, and some of those things can be tricky because they can be only seen in a rearview mirror, right? Like when, let's say if you have a yellow tinted glasses on all the time, right? And we discuss colors and, you see the difference between green and red and you say like, oh yeah, I kind of see the difference. So how could I see the difference in color more? But I would say like, if let's say we take off the glasses, then suddenly the contrast, then there's something more strike about it that we can recognize. So in the same way, some of the things can be really obvious when they are revealed and yet not that obvious when kind of pointed to or spoken. But I would say that the kind of following shift of the sort of collapse down of the awareness and its content, or however you want to call it, of that sort of non-duality proper, right? Not the non-duality as everything is one and there are objects arising within it. That's still very clear duality, awareness versus objects, right? And yet when everything, when there's this collapse and there's non-duality, it can seem like, okay, that's what else is there to kind of be seen? And yet there is almost like the sort of movement of identity itself that kind of travels initially, right? There's I am body, I am mind, right? I'm content of my thoughts, I am this body. then it can explode into, oh, I'm the whole consciousness. I'm this pure being that is just, you know, limitless. And then sometimes people go through the phase of, which could be called one mind, which means everything is part of the same thing and everything is myself, right? Everything is that one mind. But yet, I would say that there is this kind of other dropping away, which is dropping away of I am anything business, of defining ourselves as anything in particular. And it comes with dropping, even further dropping away of separation. And even if it might seem like, no, wait a minute, there's a when the collapse happened of consciousness, kind of implodes and goes right into all the phenomena, was there left to be separate? And yet the separation, it's almost like a, at this stage, it's almost like an assumption that there is an entity to which life happens. And that entity, again, initially thought it was body mind, then it thought it was consciousness, then maybe it thought it was everything. But that entity kind of defines the moment in the most subtle way after those shifts already has happened. And then there's a dropping away possible where defining reality through the lens of something that is in relation to it, whether it's about I'm all of it, I'm nothing, I'm emptiness, I'm any of it, right? That movement, self-referential movement of self, can completely drop. And then it's almost like reality alone is. And each experience become almost like a separate universe, separate reality in itself coming into being. They say the greenness of the wall is arising. And then yet when there's a movement, right? There's a change and there's something here. Before that change, there would be like sense of like, oh, there's a non-dual experience of the greenness. And then something, the same thing that experienced that greenness now is experiencing the brownness of the shelf, right? And that's precisely this sort of sense of something on a timeline, traveling the moments and collecting experiences. That is what's dropping away then. And there's just green reality in itself, total, intimate, arising to no one. And then there's just brownness shining forth, replacing everything that ever existed. And there's no one to kind of compare the two to each other. So each experience almost becomes full revelation of reality. And it's not in relationship to anything else. And although I understand it might sound almost like non-functional, and how would you plan to go, you know, how would you buy an airplane ticket? It's, you know, there is a natural unfoldment that seems to be, everything seems to be unfolding in a way that there's no issue with that, right? There's conversations are scheduled, the retreats are organized and all that. And yet there's something, again, it's a subtle thing. Then it's not like in a big bang, right? That dropping away is kind of can be quite quiet, and yet it has some consequential experiential results of further. It's kind of like there's a radical freedom in it that seems deeper than the previous stage of kind of non-duality as I described before.
Yeah. I've often and long wrestled with the notion of a complete cessation of the sense of personal self. You may have seen that conversation I had with Adyashanti and Susanna Marie about that, about 10 years ago. And, you know, because, I mean, take Adya, for example. Okay, so he was in a lot of pain for a long time, and he finally retired, and for whatever reason, he was having a lot of anxiety and took some, you know, medication for it, and he admitted that publicly, which I really respected. And, you know, so it seems, when you hear that kind of stuff, that sounds like it's happening to someone who has some kind of sense of self. It's not happening to a tree outside. It's happening to this guy, Adya, you know, and if I come into the room where you are and I say, hey, Kogan, you'll turn your head. So I've never quite grokked the idea of complete cessation of a sense of personal self. It seems more like you can say, yeah, I'm the ocean, but I'm also this wave, you know, as I've always been. But now I realize I'm much more than this wave. I'm the whole ocean. And, you know, to shift out of that analogy, I mean, we are an instrument experiencing the totality and we are that totality and we know ourselves to be that, but we're still this instrument. And Vedanta deals with it with a concept they call lesha vidya, which means faint remains of ignorance, where there's got to be some remnant of a sense of ignorance or individuality if you're going to function as a living human being. What do you think about all that?
I mean, I would say that the difference is primarily experiential, right? It's simply the sense of there being a separate existence can be very, very subtle in, let's say, you know, as you mentioned, there is a I'm just the wave, right? Then there's I'm the ocean, right? And then I can see I'm both ocean and I'm both wave at the same time. So I would say the experiential sort of difference that kind of happens there is that then it feels there is an ocean, there is a wave, but there is not that flavor that almost, you know, let's say like you have an ice cream that is strawberry flavor, right? It's almost like experience can have a flavor of my experience, right? In some form, whether I'm totality or I'm an individual, or I'm both at the same time and can see all the spectrums. And all I'm saying is that flavor of me, it's my experience, can also drop away from it. It doesn't mean that, let's say, someone comes to the room and says, like, Kogan, that there's no differentiating between that. It's simply that the sound that is arising that says Kogan has absolutely no one attached to it that could be in a relationship to that experience. And turning of the head also doesn't have that flavor. It's simply on an experiential level. And again, I think it's a very important point about us having nervous system and that even deep realization, it's not giving us free out of jail card sort of pass from all sorts of difficulties and grief and pain and discomfort. It's just that there's just something experientially that happens when that drops away, that there is no sense that refers back to anything. It's simply arising. And each of those experiences can arise, experience of being cold, experience of having preference for this food over that food that is arising. And yet there is just that little experiential difference of either it's arising to someone who is either aware of the, you know, different spectrums of being, and yet it has that kind of, you know, subtle, you know, reference point back to some subject to whom the life happens, or that can be relinquished. And therefore, even though it doesn't necessarily stand with disagreement with the point you made about some remains of us, or, you know, some remaining conditioning that needs to happen for the functionality to be there, it's perfectly fine. It's just the flavor of personal experience of like, this is my experience, whether I'm God, whether I'm ocean, whether I'm everything. If there is like this movement of it's referring back to that me, it still has simply that flavor of someone collecting the experience, traveling the timeline, going through life. And when that drops, there's some sense of freedom from that project altogether, which is hard to put into words. That's the best what I can do here.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you and I are in the same place and we're having ice cream and, you know, you like strawberry, I like chocolate, and there's some individual preference, and your knee hurts, you know, because you just tore your meniscus again, and my knee doesn't hurt. And, you know, it's like, you're saying that even though there's individual experience, which I don't have yours and you don't have mine, ultimately there is actually no person having that experience, no jiva, to use a Sanskrit term. It's just experience without any individuated experiencer whatsoever.
Yeah, without any subjective sense of there being an experiencer. Again, you know, obviously, like, you know, the experiences differ, right? The sense gates differ, like your ears, my ears, right? Maybe you hear more, maybe I hear less, maybe I see more, maybe you see less, right? We have apparatus, right? Like the fly that would be in the same room would see the whole room very differently, right? Because it has multiple eyes and it's all kind of, to us, it's psychedelic. So it's definitely, yeah, it's not about any sort of absence or presence of preference or about point of view. It's about the subjective experience that can be very, very subtle, that it happens to someone. And that can give away to the sort of, the only statement, I guess, that, you know, kind of come close, reality alone is.
Okay. Incidentally, this is a completely abrupt segue, but you know, you've spent all those years as a monk. Are you still a monk, or do you have a relationship
now?
Yeah,
so I mean, I guess maybe my status on Facebook would be it's complicated. I mean, in terms of my life situation, I mean, I'm still sort of in the form of a monk, and I, you know, I travel the world, getting involved in different retreats. I sometimes do retreats as a student myself also. I feel that's important, part of my journey. But I don't live in a monastery, right? Like I spent, you know, maybe 15 right. years living in a monasteries and in a, you know, kind of cloistered communities. But now, it seems to be not happening anymore. Zen tradition, especially Japanese Zen tradition, is very kind of Protestant tradition of Buddhism. It's very reformed, like celibacy is not requirement, and also their approach to different rules is more loose than any other tradition in Buddhism, in Mahayana even, and not to mention Theravada, which are very strict about precepts. So I have quite a bit of freedom. My teacher has passed away. I'm kind of a ronin, if you know the term. It's kind of, you know, masterless samurai, kind of. So in some way, I have a lot of freedom. So I don't feel, that's one of those things.
You're not bound by vows, in other words. But I mean, I'm just wondering if you're, I don't even know if this is a useful question, but I'm just curious. And so I'm asking, you know, whether your monastic tendencies were due to your fervent spiritual desire. And now that you're no longer living in the structure of monastic community, whether you discovered within yourself that, well, yeah, I'm not actually a monk. I'm kind of a householder and I want to be in a relationship.
Totally. That's a yes. I have to say, I'm not a householder, but I don't hold in a house. I mean, I don't have
any
base,
but...
and I'm still kind of a hobo, technically speaking. I have relationships, and you know, it's definitely one of those things, right? Like we discussed, it's just having some realization doesn't make you a perfect partner, right? Like I never had a long relationship all my life, because I was, you know, first half of my life I was obsessed with music, and second half of my life I was just in a monastery. So so it is, you know, it is a beautiful point of learning and sort of seeing how that humanity is, and also, you know, many conditioning of ours, especially like early conditioning from childhood, it tends to kind of show up more in a relationship rather than like intimate relationship rather than in a colleague, like sort of, setup. So, definitely, that is something that I tried, you know, after that, I mentioned that I had this, I was a celibate and then I had this kind of short-lived affair with this woman in that temple, and I left there, and I kind of wanted to go back to being celibate, but I think it was almost like hormones just woke up, because I, you know, for the first 10 years I was just completely celibate, and then suddenly, you know, like being close physically with someone, it kind of, so then I was seeing like, oh, I kind of keep just falling in love and getting attracted to people. So I felt like probably there's something that needs to be expressed, and that monk sort of, limited, life. Although I think it's a beautiful life. I feel a lot of gratitude for everybody who's still upholding those traditions. And, you know, the numbers are dropping across the board through all traditions. I think there's less and less monks and nuns, and those were the carriers of those spiritual teachings for so many centuries that, you know, I always have a special place in my heart to kind of monastic traditions. But yeah, it just seemed staying there. It's a little bit like maybe with, I'm absolutely not comparing myself to Vivekananda, but I'm just saying it's an analogy of that kind, that it felt like staying in a monastery would be just for myself because I just love this life and it's so, you know, it's so great to be there in this simplicity and without the digital world of you know, YouTube and Facebook and whatnot. And there's just this radical freedom in choicelessness of monastic life that I love. But it felt it would be kind of selfish to just keep only doing that for myself. So, you know,
Yeah, no, I totally understand. I mean, once you've reached a certain stage of development, it's good to share.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the world needs more people who can get out there and offer something.
Yeah,
like this.
And you know, definitely, kind of remembering my teacher. It's not that I, you know, never wish that people would just encounter my teacher other than me. There's always that sense of, you know, how vast those shoes were to fill. But you know, with the time, I guess I also understood that it's not to fill anybody else's shoes, but it's walk with integrity in one's own and trying to be of a helpful presence. And you know, that feels good and aligned. I guess I would say also, you know, even though all those things can kind of sound so extraordinary or you know, God consciousness and then collapse and then disappearance of separation, it, actually, you know, through this process, there is a little bit more and more, the more some of our realization matures, there's also like this paradox of really, you know, the sort of never ending unfolding of this luminous, vivid reality that is feels in some way extraordinary. But at the same time, there's actually this deep ordinariness of just, you know, regular dudes, you know, making scrambled eggs in the morning or whatever, right? And sort of, I feel there's also like importance to say that, you know, chasing big experiences is certainly not what this path is about. It's living out of the truth of our being that, you know, initially because of the contrast, right? There's this contraction and suffering and all that, and suddenly there's this big expanse of freedom. And yet, you know, if we constantly keep getting intoxicated with the freedom aspect of it, it kind of means that we are still kind of holding some reference point to some past experience that, oh, I was like that, now I'm like that. And there's this sort of maturation that happens that no reference point remains. And this is simply it. And therefore, it's quite ordinary in some ways. And in Zen, you know, there's this famous teaching device of the 10 Oxherding pictures where, you know, it's kind of the stages of awakening are explained. And the 8th Oxherding picture, when both the bull and the herder are kind of gone, it has this beautiful poem that starts that that picture, and it says, he has completely cast off ordinary feelings and let go of all holy thoughts. He doesn't linger where there are Buddhas. He doesn't stay for long where the Buddhas are not. With not falling into either side, 10,000 eyes cannot see him. All birds bringing flowers, that would be a disgraceful scene, right? And the last line is kind of reference to this famous story where there was this, I think it was a fourth patriarch of Zen in China, who was practicing in a cave, in a mountain cave, and entering extraordinary states of samadhi, and many birds would be flying by and dropping flowers to the front of the cave because, you know, there's this incredible energy coming off it. And then he traveled by foot and met the third patriarch of Zen, and they had some exchange, and he had this profound realization. And when he came back to the cave, you know, the birds stopped coming. Right? Because there was just just a, you know, old fellow sitting in a cave, right? There was no need for the fanfare and for the big sort of special things. It was just return to that, you know, human ordinariness in some way, even though, you know, it's like you could say that the point of 360 degrees is exactly point of 0 degrees, right? But there is some journey that needs to happen, and therefore there's this maybe dangerous or danger of giving too much teachings that are about the 360 point, because they emphasize the, you know, sort of more really mature and absolute view, that there is nothing to do and just chop your, you know, chopping wood and carrying water is the greatest miracle. And this is true, of course. But it's hopefully, you know, we have understanding that there is actually a full journey that we go embark on. And sometimes it takes commitment. I know that sometimes the word seeking seems to be, looked down upon in a certain circles. And I understand what is it pointing to. But yet, you know, I still feel about the whole spirituality, you know, of course, there are cases where people just wake up out of blue and it doesn't have any precursor to that. But I still feel about the whole thing more or less how I would think about like learning a language or learning to play an instrument, right? Like, you know, for most people for whom that comes to fruition, it happens through some dedication. It doesn't, obviously, it doesn't need to look like putting on robes and flying over to Japan and staying there in some place. And that's the beautiful part about, you know, your show that is really, you know, showing it to people that in all life walks, we can embark on this journey. But, you know, also I think remembering that there is this sort of axis of, you know, stages that go further and further. And yet there's also the sort of infinite depths of realization that that journey never ends. And even though we can arrive so many times at the place that feels like, oh, finally, I'm totally done here. You know, if we keep our mind open and keep, you know, just sincerely looking, where do we fixate? Because that's almost the key, right? Like if we fixate, even if you fixate in the absolute, just as before we fixated in the relative, you know, fixation is limiting in some way. And there's sort of diamond of awakening that has so many facets, you know, sometimes each of them is called forth in a different situation, right? Like if, let's say you're walking and your daughter is attacked by a rabid dog, right? In this moment, the aspect of everything is perfect as it is maybe not necessarily what's called forth in this moment, right? Like you have to act. You have to really do something about harm that is being done right now in a wise way, you know, whatever way you can. And in some other time, you know, there might be that very aspect of inherent perfection might be what's needed to be emphasized for someone else's benefit. So I think this sort of complex jewel of realized mind has so many facets, and fixating in any one of them is in the end limiting. So, you know, I think it's just endless, beautiful journey into the depths and into the sort of, even though, again, you know, I of course I understand the words of reality is as is. There was never anyone to suffer, or, you know, like I can experientially tune into, you know, those statements. But at the same time, this world is full of suffering, right? And just like in the analogy of a man entering the room with the snake in the room, like, you know, for some people, the snake is terrifying and doesn't let them sleep at night because they're all the time, you know, thinking they might get bitten in any instance. So therefore, skillful means, that's what I like about Zen and, you know, Buddhism at large, that it's never about like trying to provide a statement of absolute truth. It's only a pointer, like a finger pointing to the moon. Or, for example, let's say when we want to go to Iowa, right? You know, if you're in Minneapolis, I'll tell you go south, right? If you're in New York, I tell you go west. If you're in LA, I'll tell you go east. And if you're like in, I don't know, New Orleans, I'll tell you go north, right? It's really depending where is the fixation or where is the particular obstacle or where do you find yourself at that there's just like a nudging to look in a certain way, but each of the pointers are not truth in itself. It's just an empty, just like, you know, I guess Ramana Maharshi had this beautiful image of like a thorn removing a thorn, right? And after you finish that, you discard both and live in the freedom from, you know, both thorns.
There's a lot of good stuff in what you said. So many things we could talk about. I'll just make a couple of comments. One is that people tend to acclimate, you know? I mean, if you and I were feeling pretty normal right now, if we could snap suddenly to the way we felt 30 years ago or something, even though we might have felt pretty good 30 years ago, but if we were to go from this to that, we would probably be in agony because of the contrast, you know, but now we're used to this. And by the same token, if we could snap to where we might be 10 years from now, we'd be totally in bliss, even though then 10 years from now, we might think, yeah, this is normal, no big deal. You know, so we human beings tend to acclimate to whatever they're experiencing. And maybe all beings do. I don't know. But I think that's a lot of times you're talking about this profound experience you had, and you know I've had a few myself. It seems like they fade away after a while, but maybe they don't fade away. Maybe we just become accustomed to them. We metabolize them. You know, they become part of our innate normal makeup, and so they seem ordinary. I started saying all this to embellish on the word ordinary that you used. Ordinary can be extraordinary, contrasting with something else, but for the person experiencing it, it's ordinary.
Yeah, definitely. I fully agree. And I wouldn't say that, experiences, again, it's maybe semantics, right? Experience is in constant change, right? But yet realization, which means the entire paradigm from which we feel like reality to be experienced, you know, I feel like those after those shifts, they never reverted back. There's no, it's obvious as starkly in every moment as it was in the moment of revelation. But as you say, the sort of contrast.
But you're not wowed out by it anymore.
Exactly. The contrast is not, not blowing your socks off all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be hard to live that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your feet would get cold without socks. Okay. Well, that was great. I'm sure we could talk for another couple of hours. And for some reason, people didn't send in questions. I don't know why. It seems like this would have been one for lots of good questions, but no big deal. So tell us about, you mentioned you're traveling the world doing retreats and stuff. Do you have a website? How do people get in touch with you? How do they find out what you're doing?
Yeah, so I have a website, which is called seeyournature.org. I have also a YouTube channel. However, I'm not like a very good at, YouTube and all that. I mostly record stuff from retreats and post it there for some people who can't join the retreats. But that's also See Your Nature. That's the channel.
That's the YouTube channel. Okay.
Also.
And so you, on your website, if you have a retreat scheduled, you can find
it. And also I meet with people, on Zoom, and that's also on the website. Also, I mean, I'll mention just because I feel like, so much gratitude and to my teacher that the book of his teachings, which is called Throw Yourself into the House of Buddha, is the one that we kind of mentioned both during the course of this interview. And, I feel like, he was the most kind of dharmically impressive person I ever met in my life. And hopefully that comes even if a little bit through the book. So I feel that's also like a great resource for people.
It's an interesting book. I mean, he was a young man during World War II. He was a kamikaze pilot. He was like one day away from going and dying as a kamikaze pilot, but the war ended. And then he ended up in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And it was a Russian prisoner of war camp. One of the guards said, hey, have some drinks with me. So he got drunk and he was hung over the next day. And so because he was kind of in a bad state. They didn't send him to a Siberian prison camp where he would have died. And so they're like these close calls. And then he eventually, you know, became a Zen monk and master. So it was a really good biography of him.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I felt even this part when he, as a young kid, he decided just that he wants to be like a chair, right? Which means he wants to be of service in even the most simple possible ways and without even caring for any recognition, just like a chair never sort of gets its praise for being kind of people sitting on it. He had this mind of like, how can I serve? How beautiful would it be to have a heart of a chair that just serves and serves and serves. And you know, I feel that bodhisattva spirit as we discussed of you know, this world is has a lot of trouble. It's really you know, so much suffering going on, and even though it might feel overwhelming at times, it might feel like, you know, some people feel hopeless in the face of, you know, genocides, and you know, and of course I understand that. Therefore, you know, the realization part of inherent perfectness and compassion at the same time are also like two wings of the same bird. And the story that my teacher often loved to tell was that from Jataka, about the little parrot that saw this big fire, you know, consuming the jungle, and the parrot would kind of go and take in his beak one single drop of water and just fly over the fire and just drop it and go back to the lake and keep doing it. And even if it felt like a sort of this desperate, hopeless thing, at least in the story, you know, it's kind of like a tale for kids, Jataka, some of them, right? But then the parrot finally was just so exhausted, it dropped into the fire. And Brahma, you know, the god, saw the sacrifice and felt so moved that dropped this one tear, and this big tear extinguished the whole fire of the jungle. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to kind of connect to which degree we can make a difference, even if it's a difference in this one particular moment and instance. I remember I was one time doing a retreat in Auschwitz, you know, here my family lives just a kilometer away from the camps. And when the Zen Peacemaker Project was doing a retreat, their meditation retreats inside the concentration camps, you know, I went there, and we, you know, you sit in a gas chambers in a ramps where they sorted people for immediate death or work, and you know, it's pretty intense. But I remember, you know, there's this famous Polish saint Maximilian Kolbe, who basically people were lined up to every third person was going to be shot in the head in the concentration camp, and someone next to him got chosen, and this priest, he was a Catholic priest, he stepped forward and he said, please let this man be saved, and I'll you know, not knowing whether they all will be exterminated later or not. I mean, it was obviously hellish sort of situation, and he got killed for that, and then the man actually survived, and he lived a long life and had a family. And someone quoted this person as like, you know, In some situations, when you save one life, you save all of life, right? There's real, we can do something in this world, even if we can't save every kid in Gaza, or we can't, you know, fix all the problems. The way we interact with each other, the way we treat each other, the way we are for each other, brings fruit and matters to someone profoundly. So this path, it's really, you know, at the end of the day, it's not about like getting all, you know, about our having great, nice experiences. It's actually about being a benevolent presence in the world and you know, being able to meet with wisdom and compassion the great suffering that is unfolding here.
Yeah. Tell a couple of quick stories and then we'll wrap it up. So it reminds me of the starfish story that I heard you tell, and it's not clams or mussels. All it right. was starfish. So there was a big storm and the starfish all get washed up on the beach, and they're drying in the sun. They're going to die. And let's say a man and a young girl are walking along, and the girl keeps picking up starfish every few steps and throwing them in the ocean. And after a while, the guy says, look, there's thousands of them. What difference can this possibly make, picking up one here and one there? And she picks up another one, throws it in, and says, well, made a difference to that one. So there's that. And then there's this Indian story where there was this seagull who had laid its eggs in the sand, and a big wave came and washed the eggs into the sea. And she said, give me back my eggs. And the ocean was, didn't respond. And she said, all right, I'm going to make you dry. So she, if you don't give back my eggs, I'm going to make you dry. So she takes one beak full of water out of the ocean, puts it out, and then gets another one and does. And she continues to do that day and night. And, you know, what difference is it possibly making? But it caught the attention of the king of the birds, who was Garuda or something, and he could actually make the ocean dry. So he came and said, all right, give back the eggs or you're toast. And so she got her eggs back. So, you know, a lot of times just a determined effort, even though it seems futile and impossible, can yield fruit.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, I didn't know the second story, but the first one, I think I actually heard it from you and I stole it and I tell it on retreat sometimes.
Oh, there you go. You distorted it into mussels and clams.
I promise to abide by the starfish scenario. Yeah.
All righty. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate spending time with you, and keep up the good work. For those listening or watching, my next interview is going to be with a fellow named Robert Lawrence Kuhn, and I'm really looking forward to it because his podcast is one of my favorites. He has a podcast called Closer to Truth, where he interviews all these Nobel Prize winners and all these really impressive people, and he himself is brilliant, and he does a really good job, and the whole thing is really nicely produced. He's written a paper in which he summarizes nearly 400 theories of what consciousness is. And believe it or not, new theories keep popping up. It's like, here's this thing that we all have as essential constituent of our lives, and no one can agree on what it is.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that.
And thank you very much, Rick. Think of you almost like a Mr. Rogers in a spiritual scene. You know what I mean? Like you have helped so many people in so many different ways, connecting people and kind of holding space and mature conversation about, you know, this whole spiritual thing. And, you know, many people appreciate it so much. I appreciate so much. And all your team, your wife and all the volunteers, you know, it seems like it's taking a village right now to do it all. So thank you, everybody all. And it was great to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for being part of it. I don't know if I'm Mr. Rogers or Kermit the Frog, but whatever. All right. All right. So thanks, everybody. And we'll see you for the next one.